Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. Let's take our microphones to San Francisco and to one of the best-known authors, friends, the author of Galway Bay, and indeed now the author of a new book, her latest novel of Irish blood. But firstly, let me welcome Mary Pat Kelly. Hello, Mary Pat Kelly. How are you?
Very good, Adrian. Very good to be talking to you. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I don't clock as much mileage as you do, but then...
Well, this is when the book is launched. That's when I'm out, and it's been really fun.
That's great. First of all, though, you are an author, a filmmaker, you make documentaries, and you've told various stories, indeed, connected with Ireland. You're a storyteller. At the end of the day, just about everything that you have accomplished in your career is based on a story.
That's right.
Let me just ask you, though, if we go back to the first awareness that you had the gift of storytelling.
I think I come from a family of five girls and a boy, the youngest, and when we would come home from school, we'd have stories that we would want to tell my father about our day, and he'd say to us, "Girls, summarize." So I think I learned to tell your story quick, to make it brief, to get to the point, to get a laugh, and to move on. So I suppose it was that, telling stories to get my father's attention and to have the family laugh and join in, and that's where it started.
Now, you grew up in Chicago.
Correct, in Chicago.
In an Irish American family atmosphere?
Yes, although Chicago was a little different than New York or Boston because we didn't have so many people coming from Ireland all along. Most of the Irish Americans in Chicago had come over during the Great Starvation in the 1840s. Mm-hmm. And so while we were extremely proud of being Irish, it was really an Irish American, Chicago Irish identity. Really didn't know much about Ireland itself or the history. I mean, the first Irish song I ever learned was "Cheer, Cheer for Old Notre Dame."
Yeah.
It was very much that being Irish was about St. Patrick's Day and turning the river green and family parties and songs. But it wasn't really until later in my life when I started to really understand that there were many, many levels to being Irish. And I suppose it happened on my first trip to Ireland when I just was so taken by the people and the scenery. And I remember the first pub I went into, people were entertaining each other, and this man started to recite "Dangerous Dan McGrew" and "The Lovely Lady Lou." And after every verse, someone would buy him a pint. I think there's about 30 verses in that poem. So he stumbled and went down, and he looked up to me and he said, "Jesus falls the first time."
Yeah.
And then he said, I handed him a napkin, and he said, "Veronica wipes the face of Jesus." And I started to think, all these famous Irish authors, James Joyce and the rest, they didn't make anything else. They just wrote down what they heard. And it really, talk about storytelling. I thought, oh, I have to learn more about this. Then I discovered the literature of people like Queen Maeve, who led armies and took lovers. And we didn't hear about her at Marywood School for Girls, I can tell you. So
mm-hmm.
I started to get a much deeper. And then my years writing for Irish America magazine was fantastic because I started to tell stories of Irish America and learn about it. And, for example, the whole stories that I told about World War II in Northern Ireland came out of an interview I did for Irish America magazine. It led to me discover the only African-American warship in World War II whose first port of call was in Belfast, and they said the Irish were the first to treat them as Americans. So you're right, Adrian. That was really well put. Whatever the medium is, it's the story that captures me, And most of what I've worked on are true stories in some way or another.
Right. And, well, it's kind of tongue-in-cheek when, and this is personal opinion, you don't have to agree with me on this, but when you have a novel, and your latest novel of Irish blood, but it is based on your great aunt's life.
Yes.
And it follows the life of Nora Kelly, who is really thriving in the new land and in the new century of Chicago. So you have a lot of the one of the themes that run through your work. Your novels and just about everything else that you've done in film and in story, they're based on historical facts.
Absolutely. I had kind of an aha moment when I realized that I used to think history was about generals and dates and kings, but it's really about our own ancestors and what they experienced, because they were the ones who made history at all different levels. So when I realized that my family had lived through some of these great events, I wanted to tell the story from the viewpoint of the ordinary person who would meet these extraordinary people, like Maud Gonne, like Thomas Markovich, mm-hmm. like Michael Collins, but to see them as the reader might see them, as if you were encountering them, as if the reader were. And my great aunt, Honora, who preferred to be called Nora, she mm-hmm. thought it was more modern, she was named after the great-great-grandmother that was the heroine of Galway Bay. She did go to Paris as a buyer for Montgomery Ward. But in the book, to make it a little more interesting, I have her going to Paris because she's escaping from kind of the bad man of Chicago, the gambler, the roué. And when I finished the book, I dedicated it to my aunt and my mother. My aunt, 96, my mom's 94. And then I realized I have all these scenes with my great aunt and her boyfriend, and I was getting very nervous, and I went to see my aunt, and I said, you know, Aunt Marge, this is historical fiction, and I used Aunt Noni's life, but I gave her this boyfriend, and she stopped me, and she said, Aunt Noni had a lot of boyfriends. So I think I was picking up something about her that maybe made her time in Paris more interesting. But what happens to her in Paris is what happened to me when I went to Ireland, and then when I studied Irish literature, she discovers that there's a whole another level, and she does it at the Irish College, which is still in Paris, and it's been there since the 1500s,
yes.
Has this amazing library, as you know, and it's through that that she connects to a different level of Irish literature and history, but also meets the people that are planning the Irish Revolution, Maud mm-hmm. Gonne and Countess Markovitz, and Yeats comes through, and a lot of the different people that were involved. And I wanted to make it as if the reader were there running into these famous people, which you would have done because the Irish community was very close.
Yeah. A little bit about Nora Kelly. You bring us back to the turn of the century. Actually, it's 1903. And Nora Kelly she's talented, she's outspoken, progressive, and indeed no slouch. A little bit about this character that she wound up with, the Dangerous Men.
Well, that was an interesting time because families were starting to now prosper. So you would have in the same family the priest and the gambler. You would have women that were trying to maybe have a different life than their mothers had. For the first time, women could work out of the home in jobs, that they'd go to offices because the typewriter had been invented. And the feeling was that women had small fingers and they could bear repetitious motion. So they were more suited to the typewriter and they got those jobs. Mm-hmm. But they were still very close to their sisters who maybe were having 6, 7, 8 children. So it was a big mix of people. And she would have encountered someone like Tim McShane, who is based on a number of characters in Chicago who trained racehorses and had gambling casinos. Mrs. O'Leary's son, the one who supposedly started the Chicago Fire, made his money by having a gambling casino. So I just imagined someone in that situation who might have had an older woman, this Dolly McGee, who is a well-known singer in Chicago, and what would it be like for an innocent like Nora, who encounters him and falls in what she thinks is love, and then his jealousy and violence becomes a real problem for her. So I did try to explore some of the issues of women that get involved in situations where there's abuse but still have feelings for the man, how they get out of it and what happens. A friend of mine told me a very scary statistic that during the 10 years of the Vietnam War, more women were killed by their partners than soldiers died in Vietnam. So I wanted to make a little point about the dangers that women could get themselves into and the bravery and the nerve it took to get out for her.
Yeah. Would that, from, you know, from your observation then, would progressive women be in more danger? Women who chose to, you know, to climb the ladder, to, you know, to move onward and forward, would that have destabilized, for instance, the partnerships, the marriages?
Well, I think that when you don't conform, it's always difficult, and I think that it was a lot of groundbreaking thing. That was the time of the suffragists when they were being arrested and attacked. So I think when you try to move forward, it is difficult, and then I think people adapt and they move along, and women find ways to combine the roles. But at that moment, that was the first time that women were really trying to do those things and not follow the more conventional line. And because before that, most women had gotten married. I mean, I looked at the census report, they'd get married at 15, 16. And in real life, my grandmother didn't get married until she was 29. And this Aunt Noni didn't get married until she was almost 40. So it was different. And I think you're right. I think it does make you more vulnerable. But that's why you have to be brave and have some nerve and enjoy. And Paris was full of women who had not been able to fit in or conform. It was interesting to me that so many of the American women in Paris came from the Midwest. I think maybe New York offered more of a chance to live a different kind of life. But if you were living in Dayton or Pittsburgh or something, you had to find another milieu.
Let me ask you, would it be fair to say that, in fact, your new novel of Irish Blood, is it a continuation of Galway Bay, which indeed has become both an historical and a novel of great note worldwide? Do you pick up from there?
I do. She's the granddaughter of Honora Keeley Kelly, who is the heroine of Galway Bay, who brought her children over from Galway during the Great Starvation. She's the first generation to be born in America. And Honora, her grandmother, is really afraid that this generation is going to lose their sense of Irish identity because they've lost the language. They don't have the long nights by the fire where they pass down the information and the stories. And I try to say in this book that they found a different way to be Irish. And then in Of Irish Blood, Nora does go back to Ireland as part of, becomes involved in the War of Independence. And the title comes from Maud Gonne, who spoke in Chicago and said 20 million Americans of Irish blood, surely enough to free Ireland. And Nora was one of the many Irish Americans then that got involved. And I wanted to talk about that too. I was when I was in Ireland, I had a very interesting reaction from an Irish historian who said that sometimes the role of Irish America in 1916 is forgotten a little bit because not only did they finance it, which is well known, but that so many of the leaders spent time in America. And he said before that, Irish revolutionaries were really, they were Maccabeans, they were for King James, they were picking the Catholic king, and they didn't have really an idea about democracy. But when they came to America, that's when they saw, started to aspire to be a republic and to be a democratic state. So it was interesting for me to hear him say that after reading the book. And Nora represents that group. There's also some historic Irish Americans, like Governor Dunn of Illinois, and a number that came over during that period and tried to help. John Quinn is a character. He was from New York. So, yes, I am trying to show how Irish Americans and people in Ireland interacted during that time so I can continue the story of Galway Bay. What happens to the generations that are born in America and don't have the same connection to Ireland and yet feel this great pride in being Irish?
Would that, in your opinion, would that run through the last century? Are we still kind of joined at the hip?
I think so, Adrian. I mean, you know, being out here, of course, we're very aware of the students that died at Berkeley, and I think the outpouring from Irish America that happened and the feeling of a death in the family, I think we are joined at the hip and will always be.
Yeah.
I think it's hard to explain to people that don't have the experience that you can be very, very proud of being an American and still consider yourself Irish. I mean, growing up in Chicago, the best thing anybody could be was 100% Irish. And we're not in my family. I have a little germ. And my mother tells the story that when my aunt was introducing her, after my mother got engaged to my father, his aunt would say, now she's not 100% Irish, but she has two brothers who are priests. So that kind of balanced things a little bit. So I think we do have that pride and that connection. And what I want to do in my books is let Irish Americans know that it's even more of a treasure than they realize, because when you really delve into the literature and the music and get to know the people and the landscape, the more you explore, the more there is. And I think that's what's so wonderful for me and for Irish Americans that really feel connected. I mean, look at the Irish Studies. When I started, I did a PhD with a concentration in Irish Studies, but I had to have a professor do a special course. Now I think there's 350 universities across the country that have Irish Studies programs. So I think there's a great hunger. Look at people naming their children with my nieces, Aiden, and, Sirica, and Swan, and all the wonderful Irish names are being embraced again by Irish America. So I think we are joined at the hip.
Let me ask you a little bit about your own progression. You have written many books and produced documentaries, and let's just take for instance the portrait of Nobel Peace Prize winner John Hume and the SDLP party, which he led, to live for Ireland. Now, many would say that John Hume was a pacifist, somebody who had a great nose for business, so to speak. But in writing the book on John Hume, what was the first thing that you noticed, or did you know where you were heading when you started to interview, when you started to put that book together?
Well, it was interesting. I was working for Good Morning America, and friends at the Irish Consulate, this was 1976, I think, and maybe even a little earlier. And some friends at the Irish Consulate were telling me about John Hume, who wasn't very well known in this country then, and that he was leading this nonviolent civil rights struggle and his philosophy and everything. I thought it was very interesting, and I wanted to get him on the show. But the big producers felt that people wouldn't be interested, that it was too obscure. But I had my own segment called Face Off, where I would get two people to argue an issue. So I said to my friends, look, you know, Mr. Hume should come on. We'll get kind of a generic question. He could state his views. It doesn't have to really be a debate. And the word came back that Mr. Hume says Northern Ireland is too complicated to reduce to a yes-no proposition. And all the time I worked in the media, that was the only politician I ever heard that gave up a chance to be on television. So I really was interested, and I myself had been involved in the U.S. civil rights, and of course had never forgotten John Kennedy and the excitement of his election. And I felt in John Hume and the FDLP, I was seeing a party that had that same kind of idealism and the same determination to find a solution. And I suppose that's what got me interested in the beginning. And then I met Pat Hume, who I was extremely impressed with, and saw the camaraderie. And also, being from Chicago, I was realizing here's a political party that had no patronage, no jobs to give out, and still they had tens of thousands of people turning out at the polls, and all volunteers, no funding, all volunteers knocking on doors at a time when it was very difficult, when there was still a lot of violence going on and a lot of anger. From all sides, and I was very, very impressed. I loved, in the documentary, there's a great line. I was asking this young boy who was always with them, was putting up posters and doing everything, and I asked him what made him be part of it, and I was kind of thinking he would tell me some kind of an idealistic answer about he wanted peace, and he said to me, well, they're kind, they take you around places, they're a good laugh. And I thought, you know what, that's not a bad platform for a political party. So I felt, because when I went to Northern Ireland for the first time, I thought it was so beautiful, the people were so warm and welcoming, and yet the stereotype was so off-putting. And you know, my husband Martin County Tyrone, beautiful Martin Sheeran in the Spirin Mountains, and I felt that Northern Ireland was only being seen through the news and bombs and bullets, and that there was another whole story that needed to be told that made it worth our concern and worth our interest and worth peace. And I felt that's what the SDLP was doing.
And, you know, we don't have to go that far back, having particularly across America, perhaps an image that this was a religious war. This was, you know, Catholics and Protestants and the Bible and all of again, the stereotypes.
Exactly.
That indeed had to play out. Now you're a lone wolf if you consider Northern Ireland and the struggle for civil rights as having to do with religion. On one hand, on the other hand, many would say, you have to categorize them one way or the other, and that kinds of it's easier to make the identities if we just judge by the religious affiliation.
Well, I felt that really the vast majority, I would say 90%, 99% of the people were not involved in violence and wanted peace. They wanted to raise their children. They wanted to go to school. They wanted to, live lives. When I first went to Derry, there wasn't one restaurant that was open after 6 o'clock. There was movie theater. There was nothing. And people didn't want to live like that. I think it was the people that said enough and moved things forward.
Right.
Because, as you say, it really was, characterizing it as a religious war, I think, is misstating it. It's about power and about people that had been disenfranchised trying to get their share. I mean, one of the things John said in the documentary is when he was a young man, he couldn't vote in local elections because you could only vote if you owned property. And the mayor of Derry, the unionist mayor, could vote 63 times, and he couldn't vote at all. So it started out one person, one vote. So it was about power and about getting your fair share and about a just society.
And one of the things that transcends, it's not peculiar to Northern Ireland.
No.
However, it does Northern Ireland is a great example, and that is, it comes down to jobs. If you don't
Absolutely.
Have a job, if you're not able to provide for yourself, for your family, the least important aspect going forward is linking or attaching yourself either to a political party or a religious affiliation. A job is a job is a job. And as you see with varied generations, unfortunately, what it looks like is that somewhere along the line, the newborn coming into families where, there has been a jobless tradition fall into the same category. And at the end of the day, that's what makes the difference.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think jobs are essential. So you could, as you say, start a life, have a family, grow up. If that option isn't open, it's difficult. I mean, it's the same in this country where there's places of high unemployment. You need a job to have a life of dignity, and that's the way it is.
Right. You know, as we prepare now for the centenary of, indeed, the 1916 rising, which over the past 100 years have had many twists and turns, how do you see that as playing out? Again, if we were to analyze the different factions, all with a story to tell, can you see this as having, say, America with the new image of the rising, or is it going to be mixed or gathered at the end of the day?
Well, I hope myself, and I'm actually doing a program on this in Chicago, that the women of 1916 could be emphasized, because there are a few that are still well-known and are famous, like Maud Gonne and Candace Markovitz, but there were many, many women involved early on, and one of the first things they tried to do was create an awareness of what it really meant to be Irish. And remember, things were very bad. I mean, it wasn't so long before 1 million people had starved to death and 2 million had left the country.
Sure.
There was a great book that was written by three women, Ethna Carberry, Maud Gonne, and Alice Milligan. And Seamus McManus was also another one. And it was called We Sang for Ireland. And it was about the three women went to all these villages in Ireland in 1898 for the centenary of 1798.
Yeah.
And they really just reminded people of what their history was and where they came from. And Ethna Carberry was a Catholic. Maud Gonne was Church of Ireland. Mm-hmm. And Alice Milligan, I think, was a Methodist. And they would sing. Ethna Carberry wrote Roddy McCorley to talk about a hero of 1798, and they would tell stories, and then the people would tell them stories so that they would remember that there was a whole identity that wasn't based on being oppressed and being under foreign rule, and that identity could strengthen and bear fruit. And I think it was a group of poets, actually, that led the rising. And I think the role of these women, there's the three Sheehy sisters, all very
right.
active feminists. Helen, there's a lot of them. Helena Maloney, lots and lots. And they were the backbone of the whole movement. And then, of course, as the leaders were executed, they carried on. I didn't realize that Cora Pierce's mother was in the first Doyle. So it was. I would like to see that part of the story told of the impulse to have an identity and to assert it and to be Irish, and that's what they wanted to be. And
right.
Really, when you realize that the odds against them were 30,000 troops, and I think at the height of it, maybe there were 2,500 on the other side, and I think Michael Collins said that when the British agreed to a ceasefire, he was, like, astounded because they had run out of ammunition.
Yeah.
But I think the brutality of the black and tan, that's the part of the story and just the bravery of ordinary people that hang on and didn't give up and somehow made it happen and got mm-hmm. to independence. It's a great story. And it's the first real independence from a colonial power in the 20th century that set a pattern for all the other things. So
yeah.
I didn't want to get too much into the factions and the politics of it all. I prefer to look at the time when they were united in attaining independence as a way of asserting identity. And in a way, I went back to before. It was a way to get jobs, to get control over the land,
sure.
to be able to raise your family, to have prosperity, to live. You know, that's why I think John Hume's slogan is so good. He wants people to live for Ireland, not to die for it. And I think that was the impetus behind 1916. So that's the part that I hope gets recognized, and I do hope the women are remembered and celebrated.
And we don't have to recreate a story. The women were and very prominent there. It's just that I think what has happened afterwards is that the martyrdom became the poster.
Exactly.
And to that degree, we hope, first of all, I think those who have, devoted much of their lives, whether that motivation came through the generations and their own family, they have every right to express themselves. But hopefully, overall, the centenary celebrations of 1916 will be educational, and in fact, that it's not going to be, as some might fear, a political football when it's all over, everybody say, we're as well off not knowing the half of that, because now we're totally confused. So having that negativity out of the way, I hope that it will be something that we can all be very proud of.
I think so too.
Yeah. You have worked in Hollywood and a screenwriter and for Columbia Pictures, and you've produced, as you mentioned, segments for Good Morning America as associate producer and Saturday Night Live, and you're one of the little known aspects, I suppose, is that you wrote the book and the lyrics for the musical Abby's Song. How
yes,
about that?
And you were a great promoter. Remember that? I remember you gave some tickets away. And,
I sure did. And
you were a great supporter of that. And it was a great experience.
Yeah. In your own career, can you? How do you see yourself?
Well, you know what? I really appreciate you gave me something I've never been able to summarize, a storyteller, and somebody who finds different ways of telling stories. And I think sometimes it's through a book, sometimes it's through a film, the musical, and I've been so blessed because I've had these opportunities. I've found these stories that are real stories and emotional stories and been able to work with other people. I mean, it's always a team effort. And to tell the stories, and I'm really feel very blessed. And this one is especially close to my heart because it's our family story.
All of us
Irish.
It's the novel Friends is of Irish blood, and fill us in on the details, publisher. How do we get it, and how do we get it?
It's at all bookstores. It's on Amazon. It was published by Macmillan under their Forge Imprint, which is a publishing company that is owned by Thomas Doherty, and I work with his daughters there, so you can't go wrong when there are Dohertys involved, I'd say. And it's available every place, and I am out and about in libraries.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be with the librarians this weekend, so it's all over, and I hope it reflects it. It's interesting. I thought that Enda Kenny said a great thing when he said that the Irish people are a people that are generous, bold, compassionate, and joyful. And I think that's true. And even facing the difficulties of 1916 and all the things, I think that spirit is there. And I hope that of Irish blood reflects that.
Okay. Thank you for joining us. Good luck with your tour.
Thank you.
Of us, of course, have, and throughout America, have gotten to know you through Irish American Magazine. You've been an amazing, fantastic contributor, and your stories are, again, they just come out of you, and it's great. Good luck to you on the.
Well, you know what, Adrian, I'm going to give you a scoop. The Irish American Writers and Artists this year have picked Patricia Hardy, the editor of Irish American Magazine, the founding editor, as the recipient of the Eugene O'Neill Lifetime Achievement Award. Last year it was Pete Hamill. We've had William Kennedy, John Patrick Shanley, Judy Collins, and Patricia Hardy is a wonderfully deserving recipient because
you
I agree with you. Irish America for 30 years has really been in the forefront of telling our story and supporting all kinds of efforts in the community in such a beautiful, classy way. So, yes, it's been my years of writing for Irish America that really opened my mind, and I'm very, very grateful. So thank you for saying that.
Okay, and again, no person on the face of this earth more deserving, indeed, of the honor this year than Patricia Hardy. Now,
absolutely right. I agree.
Okay, the Ghent Transits of Irish Blood, and from the author of Galway Bay, one of your great fans is the number one international New York Times best-selling author, Mary Higgins Clark, and who indeed has already endorsed your story of called Of Irish Blood as a fascinating story. You can't do much
better than that, right?
Good luck to you. Good luck on the.
Thank you very much, Adrian.
All right, Mary Pat Kelly.
Thank you so much, and all the best to you.
Thank you. And friends are listening to.
I have to say one thing before we get out. I took a group of people over that wanted to see the places where Galway Bay took place, and there's a group from Chicago, and two of them didn't know, but discovered while we were over there that they were from Bohola. Bohola. Say it right for me.
Bohola.
Bohola, yes. They were one Rosemary Durkin, who I think has the connection to your family.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it was a great, you know, Mayo is always with us. So thanks a lot.
And anytime you want to link us with your book, Galway Bay, that's only a plus. We'll take it.
Good. Well, actually, I was just over and found out. I always knew I had Mayo roots, but we actually found where the Kellys were from, because finding Kellys in Mayo is not hard, right?
That's for sure. You trip on them, yeah.
You do. So thank you, Adrian.
Thank you. All right. Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, and our guest, Mary Pat Kelly, author of, again, Of Irish Blood.